In Hollywood, heroes are shown in movie theaters. But in aviation, if you're doing your job perfectly, no one notices. And no one should notice. If you make it onto the big screen in aviation, you've probably had a terrible day. In our line of work, fame is silent. Paul Edmonds is one of those silent heroes who models a career track that we all seek. He is a pilot with loads of experience as a helicopter instructor, a news pilot. He has flown helicopters in Afghanistan during the height of the war and has recently shifted his career to the airline industry. He learned how to fly planes in record time. He worked at a regional airline flying passengers and then recently switched to flying massive jets for a cargo carrier when the COVID pandemic put the brakes on passenger flying. If you want to become a helicopter pilot or an airline pilot, this episode is for you. It's also for those who are deciding on a career between passenger or cargo flying. Our decisions of today lead to the course of tomorrow, and it never hurts to listen to those who have already paid their dues. Let's give Paul a call and see what he has to say. Can you hear me now? Really? We got it. We got it now.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, I was trying to give you two options for audio, but I hope this is okay, however I sound like, because apparently, for whatever reason, it's not accepting it over the computer. I don't know if it's because it's not FaceTime or what, but...
I mean, this sounds pretty good, so I think...
Okay, well, you're the audio engineer, so I'll go by your standards here.
Right. So, man, what a ride. It's just crazy just to see the evolution of where we started and where we ended up and where we're going, you know, in this industry.
I literally, if you had asked me, you know, we've known each other for what, almost 10 years now? If you had actually asked me, you know, where do you think we'll be in 10 years? I don't think either one of us could have actually come up with what's actually happened and, you know, the opportunities that have been made available to us as well, you know, whether be on the helicopter side or, you know, on the fixed wing side, as we both are able to enjoy.
I would have predicted that we would not have been here. You know, I mean, I was biased 100% helicopters, never. Mm-hmm. I mean, until the end of 2017, I couldn't tell you what an aileron was, and I had been flying 15 years.
True. And I got to tell you, I mean, back in our days where we were working back for Bear Defense, and I know we started to go out and get the fixed wing program started. I remember having a conversation with one of our colleagues there, and I was real curious how the fixed wing side would pop up. And if you remember Chevy, of course, you know, and his heavy fixed wing background, you know, he had mentioned it was kind of the wave of the future, but I don't think I was fully convinced at that point in time that that was where it was going and where future opportunity would go ahead and lie for us. But lo and behold, you know, almost 10 years later, here we are.
Yeah. And then when he went to work for Southwest, I thought, what a silly thing to do is what I thought back then, you know, and here I am. That's like the golden standard for the best retirement setup ever, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. I think I was a little bit of a skeptic myself. I was like, I enjoy helicopters, you know, why would I ever go ahead and go over to the fixed wing side of the house? But I got to tell you now that I've had a taste of the Kool-Aid on that side, I like it.
Yeah. A lot. You know, it's the old saying goes, you get what you pay for, you know, and, mm-hmm. or you get what kind of money you work for, you know, so, mm-hmm. You know, the helicopter side is definitely more fun to fly, and it's, you know, it's fly by the seat of your pants most of the time.
No, I completely agree.
You know, the nostalgia does wear off though. You know, the excitement definitely deteriorates with time, and then you're left in a place where you feel like, now what's the most important thing is the amount of time you have off, quality of life, and what kind of nest egg you're going to have at the end of that. And that's absolutely where the fixed wing kind of pulls ahead and the juice becomes more worth the squeeze. Mm-hmm. The sacrifice, you know, cause flying the fixed wing is, I wouldn't say it's boring, but it's more boring, you know, than flying the helicopter. And it's almost like an adrenaline is a drug, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
You know, you get a little taste of the hard stuff, and going back to you know, drinking coffee is not quite the same, you know, I guess, so to speak. But that's kind of a terrible analogy, probably.
Well, maybe not. I mean, realistically, I can agree with the pretense of it, though. I mean, realistically, you know, a lot of these folks that I've been flying with over these last 3 years, you know, that have been solely fixed wing their entire career, you know, they always want to hear the stories that we have about an experience that they don't have. Most of them are actually pretty scared to fly helicopters. I don't know if you found that to be the same thing, but most of them have said, oh, you know, they shouldn't fly, and I'm too scared to fly it. And but they always want to ask you stories about the things that you've done, where you've been, what you've seen. And I find that, you know, we just have the better stories from the helicopter world than probably the fixed wing side.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of that comes from a lack of understanding on how the machine works. And
absolutely.
You know, they don't understand what happens if the engine quits, that we can glide down and land like a feather. You know, they have no idea. And which is fine. That's fine. But, you know, I think about that a lot when I fly the airplane, and I go back and I evaluate my path, my history and everything that I did to get to where I'm at. And honestly, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean,
I agree.
I really have enjoyed my time. Now, granted, I would have a larger nest egg had I had, well, maybe, I don't know, because it's cyclical. You know, I mean, what made me choose the helicopter side? What made me choose the helicopter side was the lack of movement in the fixed wing sector. I didn't even mm-hmm. think about helicopters at first. Actually, my grandfather was a private fixed wing pilot, and he said, and then he started driving trucks and working for the unions and Teamsters and things like that. But he said, you might want to be a truck driver or look at getting into the airlines. And so I did a little research when I was just ending my high school phase, and I thought, well, this is good, but the research I did led me to believe that you were going to get stuck in a regional airline as a first officer for indefinitely, you know, and it was true.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that was back in, you know, year 2000, late 90s, early 2000s, and the helicopter then was the better way to go money-wise in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
But
quicker paychecks, a faster transition generally coming outside of, you know, the training environment where you were teaching as a CFI. And then on top of it, you know, you made a little bit more money definitely early on. I mean, let's face it, it wasn't that long ago where regional pilots were only making, you know, $19,000, $20,000 a year in their entry level, you know, flying some ERJ or some CRJ for a regional airline. And it stayed like that for quite a way. And just think about the time frame in which we actually completed our training. I mean, I started training in 2006, and if I'm not mistaken, you were pretty close. Is that right?
Yeah. 2005 is when I started my helicopter stuff.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden we go ahead and look, you know, through historical events, we'll look at the financial collapse of 2008, 2009, which, you know, we couldn't really see at that point in time. But that was, for me, that was just about the time that I was transitioning from a news job into the Gulf of Mexico. It was my first turbine job, you know, so I was excited to go and, you know, fly me a 206 and 407, make a little bit more money. But if we look back, we can see where the airlines were at that point in time, and they weren't really hiring.
Yeah, if at all. And then when you go to the flight school, it was just packed full of people wearing the same white shirt uniforms, and most of them were foreign imports doing training over here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mm-hmm. it just felt like the line was too thick, and I'd rather do something a little more unique. You know, that's what steered me, and the short term better money steered me toward the helicopter side. But again, no regrets. So you did your training. You self-funded yours, right? How did you get the money to do all that?
Well, I partially self-funded it. At that point in time, I was living in Florida. I went to a small flight school down there. I was a 61, but they also had a Part 141 program. And being an Air Force veteran myself, I did have my GI Bill, which was available to me.
Perfect.
At that point in time, GI Bills worked a little bit different than they kind of do today. I was in the old Montgomery GI Bill versus the post 9/11 GI Bill, which offers aviators a lot more benefits. For instance, if they're enrolled in a Part 141 program at this point in time, and it's mixed in with college, they can not only get for more of their flight training covered, but in addition to that, you know, they can they'll get an additional housing offset. And none of that was really available to me at that point in time. So basically, I had to self-fund my entire private pilot's license, which Back then, I want to say for a private and a helicopter, somewhere around 10, maybe 12 grand, if that sounds about ballpark, right? And then everything else after that for additional certificates and ratings, the VA would actually reimburse me 60% of it. So, as with a lot of other students, or folks that are getting into this industry, we become indebted with school loans. So I made sure I enrolled into a college program. It was Utah Valley University back then. And yeah, I got some privatized school funding, and that was how I ended up funding my operation to go ahead and make it all the way up through my CFI and CFII certificates to try and make it in this crazy world that we live in.
Yeah, I mean that's a really great route. So there's kind of like three routes. You could go military like you did, not in the aviation, not as a pilot, and then you use your GI Bill, right? So that's one way to get some money. You could just enroll as a pilot in the military, right? And have them do all of your training, and then when you get out, you're already a rated pilot,
Correct.
and you just need maybe a little bit of transition time to. To learn how to fly these little tin cans and plastic baskets we fly around now, and or you could do it completely self-funded, and however you get the money from that could vary as well.
Oh, absolutely.
I borrowed it from the bank, and that was quite an effort to pay that off,
Oh, absolutely.
especially when you're only making a maximum of $20, $25 an hour, and you're limited to flying 1,000 hours a year, so. At most, your potential was 20 to 25,000 anyway. So I was like, man, the loans were higher than the income for a long time.
No,
So,
absolutely.
I had to buy a rich uncle, basically, is how that worked.
I think it really makes it hard, and I think, a lot of folks, especially as they start to look into aviation, they become very deterred by the factor of how much aviation training actually costs upfront. I mean, let's look at programs now, whether it be fixed wing or helicopter, realistically. I mean, what's the going rate to go ahead and get you all the way through, CFI, double I, if it's fixed wing, it's a multi-engine instructor as well. I've got to imagine it's in the ballpark of somewhere around 80,000 plus more at this point in time.
Yeah, 80 to like 120. And some flight schools are actually offering EASA certificates as well, or EASA licenses, sorry, with their FAA certificates. And they're adding that to the price. So
Ouch.
that's kind of an interesting, but it does give you world diversification, and it's great for people who are here on a temporary student learning visa, so they'll do their that caters to that clientele of the Europeans and everyone else who flies on the EASA licenses. And so
Oh,
they
absolutely. It's
yeah.
actually a value for them because of the cost of training that it actually costs in a lot of these EASA regulated countries themselves. We think of it as expensive here, but it's far greater expense. It's far more expensive over there, which is why they end up training over here and doing the conversion, if I'm not correct, or
Yeah.
if I'm not mistaken, excuse me.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a number of ways, and that's kind of one of the things that I want to overcome. I want to improve the quality of life for pilots, but I also but w one way to do that is to make it more accessible to them, and cost is probably the number one reason for either nobody signing up or not continuing with the training. I mean, I've had a number of students who they had a great idea. And they started training, and they realized how much it was going to cost after, getting halfway through, and they simply just ran out of money, or the ability to get money for it, So, that, and then disorganized training is a whole nother topic. The non-standardized, the issues with in that sector, but we don't need to talk about that. I'm here. I'm kind of more curious to talk about opportunity. How did you get from, being a basic helicopter flight instructor to your first, to your first job, and then what was your favorite job in the helicopter sector, and the one that paid the most, and then why did you decide to ditch all of that and go to the fixed wing? Kind of that's kind of how I'd like this conversation to go.
Oh, okay. Let's see. After I obtained my CFI double I certificate, I like most of us in the industry, I initially started teaching at the very same flight school where I'd actually learned I was offered a job by the owner from the owner just as I was working on my CFI at that point in time. After having an opportunity to go ahead and amass some time, I decided to go ahead and spend some of my own personal money, and I invested in getting some time in an R44, which at that point in time, some R44 time, which at that point in time, our flight school didn't have. We had all R22s. So I spent somewhere around 15, maybe $18,000, and I amassed some time in an R44 up in the Northeast, which was great because that actually led me to my next job after an instructor, where I had the opportunity to go ahead and fly for Metro Networks, which I believe is now labeled under iHeartRadio. And I was flying an R44, flying news for a couple of different stations down in the Tampa Bay area. Which was great. It was a nice reprieve from being in the flight instruction environment. And then in addition to that, it also offered me a good amount of time flying each day. So I was continuing to go ahead and build hours. But in addition to that, it nearly doubled my paycheck. I mean, as you know as well as I do, flight instruction typically doesn't pay a whole lot. I know back then, this was back in 2006, I think I was making $15 an hour. And we are at a quasi busy school, but we were never super busy like some of these larger places that are out there. But we still made it work. So I took the opportunity while I was a reservist actually down at MacDill Air Force Base down in Florida. And I went to speak to some of the local news helicopter pilots. And one of them, we really connected. It turns out that her future husband was actually from the same area where I grew up as well. So we all kind of really hit it off. And I developed that relationship. And I think that's one thing that we know we need to do in aviation, but we're not always great at seeing it. Sometimes we're seeing the objective and, you know, which is great, but we have to see the transition of how to get there as well. And it just turns out that, you know, another fellow pilot in the area who was flying for a news contract was getting ready to leave to go to his first EMS job. So she put me in touch with him to give me a go ahead and go and talk to the boss and go ahead and go out and fly with them. And it turns out that he was able to go ahead and resign a couple weeks later, and they offered me the job, which was great. So my first job was down there in the flying news in R44. And I got to tell you, I had some really great times down there doing that. Can't say I'd necessarily want to go ahead and do those early wake-ups anymore, but sometimes that still happens in the fixed-wing industry anyways.
So you basically got that job through a networking opportunity.
Correct. I networked, but on top of it, as I mentioned, the R44 time earlier, they were wanting candidates that had that. And basically, if I'd never gone out on my own, actually take the initiative to go and get that time, I wouldn't have been eligible for that job. So by some dumb luck and some good grace, it really kind of it worked out to my benefit to actually having to go out and do that. But yeah, networking absolutely played a critical part in me being able to get that first job.
Yeah, I mean, well, they say that opportunity is being able to take opportunity is the crossroads of being prepared, or success is the crossroads between opportunity and being prepared for it. You know, so you got to be able to take it if it's offered to you, but it's never going to be
Oh,
offered to you if you're not
absolutely.
ready to take it.
So, let's see. Next, you asked what was my favorite job.
Yes.
Well,
So you got to Afghanistan. I mean, you flew Jet Rangers and 407s and stuff like that too for the news, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I worked for Helicopters Incorporated for a short time before I ended up actually taking the job where you and I had met in Afghanistan. So I was flying ASTARs for them, as well as 206 L4s out of the Boston market. And then I had the opportunity, you know, through our mutual friend Neil, you know, I had the opportunity to go ahead and interview and come over and join you guys over in Afghanistan just shortly after you started. And honestly, that was probably my most fun job. It was just incredible to go ahead and be over there. Having served in the military, you know, I'd been to deployed environments before. I'd never necessarily been to Afghanistan, but I found it very fulfilling to go ahead and be able to go ahead and assist our patriots, our Americans, our soldiers, our airmen, our Marines, you know, in their mission during this time. So that and the paycheck wasn't too bad either.
Isn't that funny that the the most favorite thing you've done was getting shot at every day while you go flying.
I know. And people look at me like I've got a third head when I say that. And they're like, don't you get shot at? I'm like, yeah, most of the time. A lot of times you just don't even really know about it. So you don't think about it anymore. But, you know, you're right. I mean, it's it makes it real. And I know you had, you know, mentioned it in one of your other podcasts, you know, as far as kind of being an adrenaline junkie. And in a sense, that's kind of what that was. I mean, there were very severe consequences, you know, for actions or inactions where we were, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely my most interesting job for sure. No doubt about it. And, you know, I did take rounds up there and if I could go back and do it all again, I would, but I wouldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes any sense. But, and it's kind of interesting to note too, that, you know, as we transition into the fixed wing world and we start to see larger paychecks, even greater than we made while getting shot at flying helicopters. Once you hit a certain point, I know that when I was over there, you know, once the paychecks got above a certain amount every month and my bills were paid, I no longer found that being my primary motivation. For staying there. And I think that's something worth noting for the people considering leaving the helicopter business to go to the fixed wing. If you're doing it exclusively for the money, and you can survive in the helicopter business and you can see that pay scale that's satisfactory for you, once you get past a certain level, it kind of plateaus. The happiness that comes from the money does plateau. And, you know, the helicopter business still needs people. And so if your passion is there, it is worth considering staying put. You know, it's nobody has a crystal ball, but, you know, technology is increasing. The eVTOL world is growing very, very fast. And I think there's a lot of people are scared and worried about being put out of a job. Like when drones came out with the cameras better that you can take better pictures with a drone than you can a human hanging out of a helicopter, then that put us all out of a real estate photography job, you know. And I used to make a lot of money doing real estate photography down in Miami. Yeah. And that dried up 100% as soon as the DJI Phantom drone came out.
Yeah, it's amazing what the technology can go ahead and do to potentially replace, you know, certain portions of the job. Or in some industries, I think eventually it'll basically eliminate the need for that human pilot to actually be in there, you know. And like you say, it's definitely making progress. It'll be interesting to see. I'm a little bit older. I'm in my 40s now, so maybe at the trailing edge of my career, that's, you know, when we'll see that come to full fruition. But I don't know. It's I think a lot of it's just going to depend on the public trust, but it's definitely given them a lot of options to go ahead and do things, like you say, where nobody has to hang out of a helicopter anymore. You don't have to pay two people. It makes it more efficient, makes it more cost effective. You know, there are definitely some advantages to it, that's for sure.
Well, the business model, it's worth noting about the business model too. You know, to purchase a DJI drone that can take better pictures than a human can out of a helicopter, I mean, just for the price of 1 hour in one flight in a helicopter, you could purchase an entire drone that would work basically forever until you crash it. Mm-hmm. And you could take unlimited pictures, you know, with that, or good enough pictures. And
yeah, the return on investment is incredible with it.
Yeah. And so, but I don't think that's quite the case with the fixed wing yet. I know I have spoken to a lot of pilots that I've flown with in the airlines, and they've all said that, the technology does exist for an airplane to take off, fly, and land by itself without a human. I mean, that technology is there. It's there today. We got public trust, but we also have, somebody made a great point to me, that there's already how many airplanes out there flying, airline airplanes flying out there that are revenue generating machinery, right? And that's all it is to the bean counters. I mean, if they invent a plane that can do it all, they're not just going to say, well, we got a better plane, let's just burn all these and take them to the junkyard. You know, they're still going to fly these out until they time out. And as you know, these planes,
oh, absolutely,
you know, they fly for years and thousands of hours. They're not just going to throw away that revenue opportunity.
No, I completely agree. I think it would be a massive undertaking, just on the cost alone. Sure, they'll go ahead and, they'll save on, their most expensive line item, which is obviously personnel and whatnot. But, at the same token, that's going to be a really large investment. Like you say, they still have, hundreds and thousands of cycles still left on, a lot of these aircraft, and until they burn them out, I completely agree with you.
Yeah, and what worries me is Airbus is such a smart company that they probably have software embedded waiting to be unlocked to be used whenever the infrastructure can support the demand, And that kind of makes me a little bit nervous with that. So, I mean, if you were trying to sign up to be a pilot today, I would say yeah, go for it. Get your ratings. Go through the 2 to 3 years of building your first 1,500 hours to qualify for the airline transport pilot certificate, and get into a regional, and then spend 2 or 3 years, and then try to get into a major. But I would say that would be about the limit for me if I like the person, if I really liked them, and I'd say, and they say, hey, what do you think? I'd say, yeah, go for it today, but don't wait until tomorrow, or within the next year, I would get it started. So, if I had kids right now, they were being born this year or something, and they were like, Mommy, Daddy, I want to be a pilot, I'd probably say it's better to maybe get into software development or human management or something like that, or automation management or something. But I'd probably discourage them from being a pilot, starting when they're 18 years from now, then starting the process. I think it's going to be in another cyclical down for sure, if not completely replaced by then.
Yeah, it's technology is the wave of the future, so I don't think you'd be wrong in steering, anybody to go in that direction. There are tons of high-paying jobs that are out there, and it's just folks have to go ahead and reach out to go ahead and do it. But is it going to be as exciting as flying a helicopter in an airplane? I think we both know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's they're definitely going to be looking at the era that we're in as kind of how we looked at back in the day, 20s and 30s and 40s, when you're like, man, can you imagine just being back in the day? You could just punch somebody in the nose if you wanted to and get away with it. And now that would never happen. There's definitely consequences, and I think that kind of that lifestyle kind of has a certain amount of appeal to most people, feeling like you were born in the wrong era. I'm sure that the next generation is going to feel that way about the pilot generation, as they're sitting around tapping an iPad, getting from A to B. I think that they're going to wish that they had some controls under their hands and some steam gauges that we had. I know I looked at the old male pilots, the airmail pilots, and Amelia Earhart and Howard Hughes and all those guys, and inventing planes. I thought that would have been probably a really cool time to be around.
Oh no, absolutely. But even just given, the past and what we have today, I mean, aviation has made some historical leaps. So I think it'll be very interesting in another, 15, 20 years, like you say, how much of that is really going to go ahead and change. And like you say, in a way, I think I'm going to feel like I'm a dinosaur.
So which airplane are you flying now?
Currently, I'm flying the Boeing 767 and 757.
Okay, so, and those are mostly steam gauges, huh? Old school.
Actually, they were originally manufactured that way, and we do have a couple different variants that actually do have some round gauges on it still. But for the most part, our company has been really great about actually upgrading our fleet and attempting to make modifications to over time standardize the fleet itself. So we actually have two screens up there, which have replaced most of the round gauges that we're used to seeing. So it makes it very similar to an ERJ or, 175 or 145. As a matter of fact, funny story, I actually just had a captain that jump seated with us on his way to work this last rotation here. And he had previously been on the 767 for a big portion of his career. And he was literally blown away by the end of the flight on just how much upgrades have happened to these cockpits in the meantime. He's currently on the 787, as a matter of fact. And he's like, this is a 7.6 that is almost dressed like a 7.8. Now, I've been inside of a 7.8, and I wouldn't call it quite the same, but he was solely impressed, with just the fact that, there was so much technology that was packed into it now that really wasn't there back when he was flying.
Yeah, I was talking to another cargo pilot, and they were saying that they're still using VOR navigation. They don't even have like the most modern GPS systems in there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that just blew me away. So, you know, I think that kind of goes to what we were saying before. They're not just going to throw the stuff away. If it's still capable of making money, they're still going to be using it, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of the airframes that we're flying at this point in time at my company, you know, many of them are in the 30, almost 40-year-old range. So, you know, a lot of that, the new fancy stuff that we were used to seeing, you know, this is old school technology, but it still works and it still works well. And they've been able to upgrade certain components of it, but, you know, it still flies great, still does a good job. So, you know, we'll go ahead and continue to run these aircraft until we're told otherwise.
Yeah. And that being said too, you know, Delta just purchased a large order of 25 new Airbus A321s, right? And JetBlue is investing into replacing the old Embraer 190s with the A220s. So they're replacing those at a rate that is going to replace all the Embraers in their fleet with Airbus here shortly. And it's kind of an interest. I bought a little bit of stock just for fun, some penny stocks in it, just to, I definitely think that's definitely a growing company, you know?
Oh no, absolutely. It's good to see that these old airframes are still getting put to use though, as they go and send them out. For instance, like my company, they actually acquired some aircraft from American. Amazon has recently acquired some of the ones from Delta. You know, with all these aging 121 passenger carriers that are getting rid of their fleet, they're getting this whole new life over there. So as, you know, these other, you know, named carriers go ahead and get their new jets and whatnot. So it's great.
What was your transition like? Well, so where were you at? What were you doing when you decided to go airline? You're going to go, okay, I'm going to do the airline thing. Tell me about like what made you make that decision, and then what was the transition like for you after being a very experienced helicopter pilot?
Well, it actually started off when I was working in Afghanistan. I was working for another company doing some contracting over there. And I happened to come across an article that was starting to talk about how we're starting to have this major influx of airline pilots that were going to be retiring. And they were actually projecting some of these numbers. Now, if you're like me, when I, you know, originally went to flight school for helicopters, I was kind of told the same thing. Oh, you know, all these pilots going to be retiring. And I'm not sure that ever really happened on the helicopter side. If it did, it was just enough to create a void of, you know, qualified pilots at that point in time. But they were able to go ahead and project these hard numbers, which made me really curious. So started doing a little bit more looking into it in my off time and decided to go ahead and get my private pilot's license. While going through that process, I paid for that out of pocket at that point in time. I was kind of waiting around, and my contract had actually expired over in Afghanistan. So I came back and actually stepped away from aviation for a little bit, and I became a police officer. And probably about 6 to 8 months in the process of, you know, after graduating the police academy, I'd found more opportunities for what they would call an RTP, so a rotary transition pilot. I've really started to become curious about it, and I said to myself, this could be a good opportunity. Well, in the beginning, it was a lot of these RTPs that particularly these regional carriers were offering were definitely geared more towards the military pilot because they could go ahead and get a restricted ATP. And I tried to knock on a couple doors, and, you know, I wasn't really having a whole lot of success. And, you know, the funny thing about that is I actually remember the very specific day that you called me and you're like, I think I'm going to go ahead and get my airplane ratings and go to the airline. I bet it was only 2 or 3 days before that I'd said the same exact thing to myself, which I've always thought was funny. I've always remembered that conversation. So,
well, I wish we had recorded that one, by the way. That was, I mean, we were pros and cons for over an hour on what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, and it's funny to go ahead and look back. I probably haven't thought about that conversation in a very long time. And, you know, just to think back and, you know, bouncing ideas off one another. But it's good times. But anyways, going back to the story. So I finally was able to go ahead and knock on enough doors where their particular airline that I was interested in at that point in time was SkyWest. You know, they were interested in taking these RTP candidates who were also civilian trained like I was. Most of it in the meantime had kind of almost been restricted as far as funding to the military pilots. But I finally got my big break, and I was able to go ahead and apply through them. Basically, what they did was they offered me a certain amount of money. I think it was about $27,500 at that point in time, split between two different payments and a job. My only goal at that point in time was to go ahead and finish my fixed wing training. Still had to get my instrument, my commercial, multi-engine, and I had to build the 250 hours of PIC time in an airplane. So I went ahead and I found a flight school up in just outside of Salt Lake City in Utah. I spent about 2.5 months up there finishing, buttoning up all that, which all that funding from SkyWest was able to go ahead and take care of the financial burden that was, you know, put on me by going out and actually adding these add-on ratings to. And a week and a half, maybe at best, after I completed my multi-engine rating, I was literally sitting in an in-doc class at a regional airline learning how to fly an Embraer 175. It was a pretty fast transition.
How long did it take you from the time you made the, well, from the time you started your training until you were done with your ATP-CTP school? How long did that take?
About 3 months.
Yeah.
The program that I went to, they advertised where they would take you from a helicopter pilot with zero fixed wing hours to all of the ratings that you would need, plus your 250 PIC in about 4 months. I already had a little bit of airplane time because I had already finished out my private pilot, and I did a few hours of instrument training as well. So those items helped me accelerate that timetable. And yeah, literally from the time of from the start of training up until the time I walked through the doors at Flight Safety in Denver was just about 3 months.
Yeah, that was about the same for me too. And what a head scratcher that the initial helicopter commercial certificate only takes 150 hours, while the fixed wing takes 250 hours, but it's twice as easy to fly. I can't wrap my head around that.
You know, it's funny. I've had those same conversations with some of our pilots, you know, that I've flown with the different airlines now. And they're like, oh, the helicopter side is so much more expensive. And I don't know what your opinion is. My thought is cost-wise, if you were going to go do both programs, they're really not massively different. I mean, they're somewhere within about a $10,000 range. Could you agree with that?
Yeah.
That's general. It depends on, you know, which part of the country and a few other things like that. And, you know, I would talk about hourly rates and they'd start doing math in their head and they're like, oh, well, you know, if a helicopter's $300 an hour, how are you doing this for that? And I'm like, our commercial is only 150 hours. It's not 200, you know, it's not 250 hours. And everybody just turns and stares and, you know, they give the same look of confusion. They didn't know that, you know?
Yeah. It just blows my mind, but that's a good point though. I mean, the amount of hour requirements may have been adjusted to let people get into the business, because otherwise it would just be, I mean, it wouldn't be anything compared to the cost of, you know, military flight training, but it would definitely be, you know, almost twice as what it is today.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. You go and tack on another 100 hours on top of that, you know.
Yeah.
Be interesting.
Yeah, I think that there's what, around 15,000. Commercial helicopter pilots, and that's combined with, you know, military and fixed wing, or military and civilian trained, but I'm sure there would be a whole lot less civilian trained. I know I probably wouldn't have been able to do it for sure, you know, because I mean my loan was already 80,000 to do that. It would have been 130 150,000 then plus interest, and and I was paying 26% back then. That was crazy.
Ouch. Yeah, the 2006 rates were not friendly to loans, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it was an unsecured cash loan, and you know, that's a whole other story. But yeah, I think that that it's a good move, you know, to go to the fixed wing. I think it's a good move right now to get into aviation. And you want to talk about a little bit of the pros and cons? What steered you? Remember let's talk about that conversation. Let's try to revive some of those little pros and cons.
Sure.
One of the pros is money, obviously. You know, the business model for an airplane is just simply greater than the one for a helicopter. You know, it's similar operating costs for the machine, but you know, hundreds of billable seats versus one, two, or three. You know, so the business model lends for a larger profit model, so that you can pay the pilots a little bit more, a lot more. Mm-hmm. But you know, something comes at a cost, and that's time away from home. You know, so that's also, you know, we considered that as well. And you were working as a police officer, right? You, like, what made you go from, okay, I'm abandoning the helicopter business and I'm just going to be, it was being home part of that decision?
It was at that point in time. You know, I'd obviously done a fair bit of contracting and worked over in the Middle East for a little over 5 years at that point in time. So I was kind of looking forward to being home. I figured, you know, hey, this is a good local job. They did have an aviation unit that I could eventually work my way into after I had enough experience. But I got to tell you, the more and more that I read about these programs as far as, you know, the RTPs coming about and the opportunity to come up, and then the more research I did on, you know, the lifestyle, the retirement alone kind of makes it worth it. I definitely decided that was the route that I needed to go ahead and go, because it would create far more of a comfortable environment for myself and for my family to go ahead and do that than it would to go ahead and stay on the rotor side, or even as a police officer at that point in time, which it required me to go ahead and, while I was in the police academy, they updated it to 33 years, I think it was. And that was going to be a long time, as where the airline, you know, I could be mandatorily forced to go ahead and leave by the time I was 65. Those were the main things. You know, I felt comfortable leaving the rotor side and the police department itself. But particularly the rotor side, I've made about as much money as I was really going to make in the industry. It's not really a secret that overseas jobs generally pay more than most of your commercial jobs that you're going to have here inside the United States. So pretty much most things were going to be a downgrade, with the exception of a few jobs that are out there.
Yeah, coming home, you mean, from overseas. And,
oh, absolutely.
And conflict jobs, you know, that's not job security either. Anything can happen. And, you know, if you're looking really long term, once you get into your 40s and you cross that 40s, and I'm in my 40s and 50s range, you start to appreciate stability and dependability and predictability with your future, you know, whereas it's more of an adventure.
Absolutely.
You know, you appreciate the adventure when you're younger, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I did, and I really enjoyed it at that point in time. And I kind of say it was one of the crappiest and also one of the best things that happened to me, was the fact that the employer who I was working for in Afghanistan at that point in time, they had lost the contract, and we were subs, so since we were not the primary contract holders, we didn't have first right of refusal. So it actually forced me to go ahead and reapply or go somewhere else or work in another segment of the industry. So it was good, because I'll tell you what, I was very comfortable. The job was fairly easy. I was making really good money, had a pretty good lifestyle. It was too comfortable. But, you know, like you say, those jobs aren't designed for forever, and I'm glad that it did. And when it did, because it forced me to go ahead and reshape my thinking and kind of move forward. And, you know, that was when I started looking even more into the fixed wing side of it.
So schedule, let's talk a little bit about schedules. Because I think that the schedule really is the biggest factor, along with money, but it's the biggest factor with quality of life in your work. Good culture is another really big one. I think that's undervalued. Mm-hmm. and people just look at the money but if you can find a great group of people to work for, and that really makes a difference in the day to day when you're at work. I mean, you spend half your life working or more. so I think what's hard for many people to understand is the non-standard types of schedules, you know, and as humans, we like to generalize. We like to say, oh, what's your schedule like? Do you fly the same routes, or what's your typical route? Or you can't answer. It's different every day, every week, every month, if you want it to be.
It really is.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's nothing predictable about it, but there's the thing with the airlines that with time, with seniority, you can choose the schedule you want, the time of day that you start, how many days in a row you work, how many days in a row off you're going to get, which days off you're going to get. And with more seniority comes more control over that, you know.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you got to pay your dues. This is no secret. I found with the rotor side, especially with EMS, I mean, that's really predictable. You, for 5-10 years out, You know what your schedule is going to be. You know which Christmases you're going to be home, which ones you're going to miss, which birthdays of your kids or friends or family that you're going to miss, and which ones you're going to be able to make. But
which isn't always a bad thing.
That, yeah, right. You're gone. You're 7 days on, 7 days off, 7 days on, 7 days off forever, and you can just put a repeating event in your Google Calendar, and you know exactly where you're going to be, when you're going to be there. Mm-hmm. And I do like that, but I also I prefer the sun to wake me up than a alarm clock. I'm just not a fan mm-hmm. of alarm clock. I prefer the natural light to wake me up. It's just a personal preference of mine. So
natural rising, as I like to call it.
You know, that attracts me to be able to do that. Never ever to have to hit an alarm clock again is something that excites me. It's a big part of my one factor in my quality of life, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can choose 11 o'clock or noon start times indefinitely with time. Of course, the first few years you're going to be flying the red eyes and being up all night and early wake ups and 4 a.m. shows and all that other stuff, you know. But with time, there's definitely the flexibility, which is which could be a pro or a con depending on where your values are, you know.
No, absolutely. And a lot of that can change just, you know, depending on the airline side, just depending upon, you know, which carrier you work for, what domicile you're in. For my only regional carrier, I actually happen to be at the most junior base in our system. So generally folks would get put there right out of training. Next thing you know, as soon as they had the first opportunity, first time that they had an opportunity to go ahead and transfer out, you know, to another base, whether it was Salt Lake or somewhere in California, Chicago, wherever it was, they were gone. Which, you know, having only been at the company a year, I had really good seniority in my base, which allowed me extraordinary flexibility to go ahead and bid the trips I wanted, more so just because I happened to be located in a domicile that not a lot of people at that point in time wanted. So there are definitely some ways to work within the system if you have flexibility.
Yeah, living in a domicile, I would say that's probably a great place to start if you're thinking about switching, is look at the domiciles of the airlines that are close to you. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. if being home is your number one quality of life factor, and what do you want to do, you know, if you want to go airlines or helicopters or stay in helicopters and not go airlines, you know, with those EMS jobs, if you're living in the same location, that's one of the best jobs around. Of course, you got to work, work nights. Nights is a whole nother mm-hmm. thing. You know, your 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. can take its toll on your pituitary gland over a long term. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, theoretically, you could be home almost every single day of the month if you bid reserve and you live in domicile, you know. I mean,
oh, absolutely. Even some of the lines work that. I mean, you know, if you look between the different airlines itself, for instance, a lot of the trips for Allegiant, you know, for a low-cost carrier, there are a lot of folks that want to go out and go there because that's one of the things that they advertise is, you know, if you can live in domicile and if you happen to live in a city where one of their bases is, you know, a lot of your trips will end, you know, start that morning and then end that evening and you're sleeping in your own bed. But for instance, I actually was corresponding with one of the people that I work with, and he happens to live in Phoenix, and we just got our bids this month for our schedule a few days ago. He lives in Phoenix. He's only been here probably about 2 years, and he has 5 overnights in his hometown on our schedule. So, I mean, he's running almost a little over a third, you know, of the amount of days that he's going to be on a schedule. He's literally going to be in his own bed at night. I mean, so as much as a lot of folks in the helicopter side, myself included back then, thought, oh, well, you know, hey, it's always just city, I can never be home. Depending upon where you live, that may not very well be the case.
Yeah, and that kind of leads me to want to talk about that personality test. Didn't you have some personality testing you did recently, or you were mentioning that? Because I took the personality test for Allegiant, and I think I selected the answers to the more extreme side of things. You know, like, for example, it would say, do you like your cockpit neatly organized, or is it okay if it's in disarray, or do you like it neatly organized? And the answers were strongly agree, you know, agree, or strongly disagree. Mm-hmm. And you know, do I like my cockpit neatly organized? Yes, strongly agree.
Absolutely.
And I think I probably swung those needles a little too far throughout the entire exam. And and they gave me the, we don't want you, no thanks. But that could have been because I probably only had about 500 hours of fixed wing time at that time when I applied too. So it could have been a number of reasons, but I almost think that it was the personality thing because I had heard some other people getting hired low time as well. So I don't know.
You know, what's interesting about that, at my previous employer, I actually had a one-star general that had retired from the Air Force that was actually flying. He had, throughout his career, he had flown C-17s and a couple other aircraft. You know, he was in more of a commanding position when he had left. So when I figured out that he was a pilot in the Air Force, I was very interested to hear how come he ended up at a regional carrier versus, you know, maybe going to some of the majors. And one of the things that he had mentioned is, you know, like say he was in one of those administrative commanding positions, so he needed to go and get some currency. Well, I know he was very excited to go out and go to one of the big three carriers. And when he actually took that personality or that entry test that they give you, the psychological exam, some of them call it a Hogan, but they're kind of all the same thing with different names. He actually didn't pass it, which I found really interesting. You know, here he is, you know, he's flown for 20 plus years, and suddenly he couldn't pass that portion. And I wonder, like you say, is for the most part, most of us, I'd like to think, are, you know, type A type personalities. You know, we can be very strong. And I wonder if sometimes it's just too strong in that environment, which you wonder, did helicopters have anything to do with that, especially with the amount of single pilot that we actually do throughout our career? You know, does that affect us one way or the other, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. But also it's kind of an interesting thing when you take those tests, you know, you're answering based on what you think they want to hear rather than maybe, you know, maybe you lean, oh, you know, I'm sure that they want somebody with a neatly organized cockpit. I better slide that one full mm-hmm. agree, you know? And those thoughts definitely influence your decision to which one you choose.
No, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of folks try and do. They try and answer the question in the fashion which they think they want it answered versus answering it how you specifically would answer it. Now, granted, I've taken a couple of those in my life. At the same time, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't really know the science behind, you know, what makes your score go up / down, you know, where's that balance point, that tripping point, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think it's worth some research. I know there's a couple of career development companies out there that mm-hmm. have some coaching on those Hogan tests. So, I would highly recommend at least scanning through that or purchasing their interview prep programs because, it can really, give you the advantage of, you know, being able to work in your hometown and get all those things that you want. And rather than just, you know, you failed it because you were not prepared and now you're off to a competing airline that, you know, now you're on your way to Atlanta or something, but which is still mm-hmm. not a terrible thing. I mean, commuting is, you can ride for free to work and stuff, but it does take 2 to 3 or 4 extra full days out of your month.
Oh yeah. Let's be honest. Commuting is not the way to go if you can avoid it. I lived in domicile my last year at my last airline, and I'll tell you what, it makes it so much easier to go and take a 25-minute ride home than it does, you know, my current company, one of the last captains I was flying with, at the end of the trip, our company actually pays for paid tickets home, so we don't have to commute per se, if you will, on our off time. But nonetheless, he flies into Denver, but he lives in the middle of Kansas. It's a 4-hour drive for him to go and, you know, go home every single time. Now, granted, that's probably a little extreme for most commuting pilots, but even if it's, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours to get to the airport, like you say, if you're doing 3 to 4 trips a month, that really adds up to time and it strips away a little bit of your quality of life.
Yeah.
I would avoid, if it were me, I would avoid commuting to the extent possible, but I realize it's not always going to be avoidable in every situation.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that we all have to consider, you know, and what kind of stinks is you build roots and you grow a life somewhere, but you don't work for the airline that's there because you failed the Hogan test or, mm-hmm. you know, the competition was too stiff or something. So I think there's a lot of shuffling around that could be mitigated if everybody just communicated a little bit and like, hey, I'll trade you my job at JetBlue for your job at American if I can work there, you know, if I can live home, you know? I mean, wouldn't that be neat?
And that would be something interesting. It's almost, like a nationalized system where, you know, you can float to everywhere, which I'm sure you know, each individual corporation and their shareholders wouldn't be thrilled about that. But in the end, maybe it works. Look how many of these, you know, how many of these countries across the globe have, you know, national airlines. Now, granted, they're funded by the government themselves, but you know, there may only be one or two airlines that operate out of the entire country. It would make it simpler.
Well, and look at how many revenue generating seats are being occupied by commuting, you know, crew members. So something else to think about too.
I
So
think that's interesting.
what do you have any advice? What would be your number one piece of advice for somebody who is looking at going from rotor to fixed? Would you say cargo? Because you're what's your schedule like? 18 days on, right, or so, give or take?
I'm in the cargo world now. I switched over just over a year ago, as a matter of fact. Currently, my schedule is actually 16 and 12. So we work a combination of 28-day cycles throughout the year. So 16 days, and it can be less than that. It can be down towards 14. And as a matter of fact, our first day and then the last day, whether it be that 14th or that 16th day, those are travel days to and from work. So particularly when I bid trips out of, I live just outside of New York City, but our company also flies into JFK. So if I can get one of those nice trips that happens to start and or both in JFK, that saves me those commuting days on the end. So there have literally been days where, you know, on a 15 day on, 13 day off schedule, you know, I've knocked that down to 13 days just simply because I didn't have to end up commuting. So, but I do like the cargo side. It's a, like we say, it's a little bit different of a schedule, but let's see, it was in March. I had 22 days off in a row straight, not using any vacation, depending upon how you bid. You can really have a massive amount of time off. And folks seem to think that, you know, hey, being away for, you know, 14 or 16 days is a long time. And I'm not going to say that it isn't, but at the same token, I'll also say you also have a massive chunk of time off as well, which affords you so much flexibility. If you're, for instance, one of the things I love doing is cruising, which has been a little hard during this pandemic since we have no cruises. But, you know, typical cruise is going to run you somewhere around 7 to 9 days, you know. But a lot of folks, they can only do that maybe once a year if they have the right amount of vacation. It takes coordination. You know, I've got that flexibility to do it nearly every month if I realistically wanted to. So I enjoy that unique schedule, and I think it's a lot like the overseas schedule that I had the last time I worked over there. It was a 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off type operation. So I really enjoy that schedule. Not that I didn't enjoy my first 121 carrier, where typical trip length was, you know, it was 4 days on, I'd have 2 to 3 days off, I'd have another 4 day trip. Not that those are bad, but I do enjoy these bigger blocks of time off.
Right.
But that's kind of the good thing is, you know, there's enough flexibility in the fixed wing world where if you want to be home based, or you know, maybe you want to schedule like I do, where you have bigger blocks of time off, you know, there's a lot of variety out there for folks. So just do your research, try and decide what is important, most important to you. Try and have a couple things at the top because sometimes you may have to sacrifice one for the other. Decide what items are going to be most important to you and try and tailor your response to go ahead and work your way into that.
Yeah, there's that's the golden triangle, right? And we're and you can only have two out of three, but we're always shooting for three out
That's
of
right.
two. You know, time, money, and quality of work, and
Pick two.
you get to pick two. Yep, exactly.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right about that. But I got to tell you, I've got great time off now. It affords me, you know, a good work-life balance. Now, of course, it makes it a little bit more difficult during COVID times. But as we go ahead and move forward, I think we're going to see that change. So it's been really good. I mean, the retirements are definitely a lot better. I definitely say do all your research on your companies and just see what's out there and what you think might interest you and talk to folks out there. For instance, I never imagined myself in the cargo world. I kind of enjoyed flying passengers. I really did. Then with one random conversation, you know, with another member from an organization which you know as well, RTAG, you know, suddenly I was kind of convinced that, you know, maybe I've been overlooking one of the things that might best suit me, and that happened to be the cargo world. And I gave it a go. I ended up applying, get an interview, and here I am a year later, and I'm super happy with my decision.
Right. Yeah. So it's case by case scenario, but there is a choice these days.
Absolutely.
There was a point in time, just pre 2017, where you applied to all of them and you took the first one you would get. And
you're absolutely right.
Whether that even be in the corporate world or the airlines or whatever, I mean, you just took the first one that you'd get. And I've just turned down several corporate jobs and to go back to the airlines after the COVID pandemic kind of punched us all back to the helicopter business for a while or wherever. As things are spooling back up, there's definitely a choice, and it definitely matters that you do your research and choose the best one. Cause, once you get to the airline level, past the regionals, that's pretty much going to be your last job because of seniority, and seniority is everything there, So, I think it's definitely worth your time.
I've enjoyed not updating my resume for the last year. I can't tell you how much that makes me happy. It's good. It's good to have a home.
Yeah. Yeah. And one that's is going to be around. Heck, this COVID pandemic was worse than it did worse to the industry than 9/11 and in the recession, mm-hmm. Combined. And it took a year, and it's bounced. Everybody's hiring again, so. Mm-hmm. That gives you a little bit of peace of mind. Like, hey, worst case scenario, you're going to get a year, maybe two off due to a short term furlough or something in the future. But I got to tell you, having a few days off, I've had the last 6 weeks off, as I've started my background checks again to get back into the airlines, I decided to punch out of the helicopter business a little early and take some of these summer months off, and just enjoy the summer for the first time since I started working at 13. And if I could have the money or the time off right now, I'd just take that time off again,
But, no, I agree. And it's been interesting times, like you say, with the downturn in the economy, COVID, with everything that's happened in the last year. And a lot of folks have, had that quality time to go ahead and be home, albeit mostly not of their choice. But, I don't think you're the only one. I think we're going to find that there are going to be a lot of rotor folks that kind of went back to the Roto world for a safe haven during this. They're going to give more consideration, or they're going to go ahead and return to their jobs in the airlines, if not a different airline. So that'll be good. But, like you say, it's cyclical in nature. All of this is waves. It seems to hit somewhere around every 8 to 12 years historically, I think, if you look back through the time. And, when you and I got in, it was kind of right at that right moment, but there were some factors that we didn't know. But here the wave is getting ready to go and pick back up again, and we're going to have a lot of great opportunities. All aviators are going to have great opportunities in front of them.
Well, Paul, I appreciate your time, brother, and no pun intended. we'll definitely look forward to flying the friendly skies together, and I'm glad you got back into aviation after taking a little break, have a good one and be safe, and we'll talk soon.
It's been a great ride, and I've definitely made some great friends and met some great people along the way. Just like you, it's great that we're able to go and, talk about our experiences, years down the road of, the things that we experienced. So I wish you well and everything that you're doing as well. Hope you enjoy your time off, and hopefully everything goes smooth with the process.
All right. Sounds good. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. See ya. Well, I hope you enjoyed that call with Paul. He is a wealth of knowledge, and we're pretty excited to see how this career goes. Feel free to reach out to us on all the social medias. Check out our website, avicair.com. Have a great day. See ya.